Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to WDRT listener supported radio here in Viroqua, Wisconsin, 91.9 on your dial. You're listening to The Skeptical Naturopath with Paul Rute and Christina DeRocher. Good morning, Paul.
Hi, Christina. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you?
I'm good. It's a beautiful day.
Indeed.
It's sunny. So, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I would like to talk about a book that you have just, well, I don't know when you've read it, but what is The Glucose Revolution all about?
Yeah, so, you know, it's kind of how I read books. You know, it's another popular diet book. I have students, you know, review popular diet books. And, you know, Popular diet books are they a dime a dozen? I'm not sure, but there's certainly this effort by the publishing industry that we got to keep churning out, you know, new diet books and new kinds of things. But anyway, so this book, I don't even know that I even read it completely, right? Kind of, you know, how quickly can you read a book? I think I've maybe spent a half hour with it because I kind of know how it's laid out. And, you know, these popular diet books all follow a certain recipe, right? And actually, I read from the backwards forward, right? I read the index because the index is going to tell me what words, what captions, what phrases are throughout the book. And then that usually gives me a really good frame of reference rather than reading the table of contents and going forward. But anyways, The Glucose Revolution. So, you know, we've been talking about continuous glucose monitors, which is kind of my latest obsession, perhaps, right? So I think we talked last time on hormones, right? We did a two-part hormone kind of thing. But I mean, I've been using CGMs. I wear them. I mean, I've worn one myself. I use them with patients. And you can now you can purchase a glucose monitor without a script. So you can just basically buy it online. And there's two different companies that put this out, and you can put this monitor on that tracks your glucose continuously for 2 weeks. So in other words, it gives you all this information, and it's kind of like, whoa, now what do I do with that, right? So this book is kind of just giving you sort of some tricks. I mean, Jessie and Chauspa, I don't know if that's how to pronounce her name, but she's online as the glucose goddess. I mean, quite popular. You easily find her and all her stuff. But this is a book that she wrote perhaps early on just things that you can do, like kind of strategies, eating strategies to keep your glucose from spiking, right? So that's kind of the intent of this book. So it's kind of broken up into four parts. The first part is, you know, sort of explaining what is glucose. So let's just start there, right? Because I'm a teacher. So what is glucose? Christina, can you tell me what glucose is?
Glucose to me is a sugar. It's a way of, we all need a certain amount of sweetness, right, in our food to keep us going. It's a kind of an energy for us.
Yep. Glucose is like energy du jour in the body, right? So when we eat glucose, we basically, the body says, burn glucose, right? So all our cells in our body can use glucose as energy, and they would prefer it. I mean, prefer, right? Is it like they make a choice? I'm not sure they make a choice. It's just that elevated glucose is a problem. So glucose is that quick energy source. We eat it, and then we need to use it. And if we don't use it, what do we do with it?
Store it.
Yeah, right. So this is the whole, you know, this is the whole obesity epidemic. Like, how do we figure out how to eat just enough energy that we need instead of energy that we don't want to store any, right? And I wish it was that simple, but the problem with humans is that we always eat more than we need, right? So we eat a meal and we don't have to keep eating. So we eat and then we clear our digestive tract, and then we kind of use what we just ate for the next 4 hours, the next 6 hours until we're going to eat again, right? So, you know, cows are different. Orangutans are different, right? Because they're constantly providing energy from their gastrointestinal tract. Like, they never really clear their tract, whereas we have a shorter digestive tract, kind of like lions and cats and things, that we clear that out of our bloodstream pretty quickly, but we clear it and we got to put it somewhere. So it goes somewhere, and where is it going to go, right? But glucose, so we eat glucose, and glucose, we think of it as sugar, and really it's like blood sugar, right? We use the term blood sugar. Typically when we say that, we mean blood glucose. But that's not quite the same thing as the, you know, the cane sugar that we put in the honey and the maple syrup and all these sweeteners that we use, right? So there's kind of this... I mean, I've certainly talked about this, but like, what's the difference between glucose? So glucose is different than, you know, quote unquote, table sugar. Can you tell me right. what makes it different?
You were talking about saccharides, right?
Monosaccharide. Yep. Monosaccharide means it's a single sugar molecule. So there's three different single sugar molecules. One is glucose. Do you know what the other big one is? It's from fruit sugar.
It's what?
It's
I'm
from
sorry?
We call it fruit sugar.
Fructose.
Yes, fructose. So we have glucose, we have fructose, and then the third one is galactose. And galactose, for all intents and purposes, we find that in dairy products. So
right.
when you eat yogurt, even if you eat plain yogurt, that's not sweet at all. You look at the label. And you look at sugar content, and you're like, oh, my gosh, there's sugar in plain yogurt. Who added it? Right? Nobody added it. Well, if it doesn't taste sweet, they didn't really add it. But the thing is that's milk sugar, right? That's lactose. And lactose gets broken down into galactose, which is the monosaccharide. Mono means it can't be broke down any further, and that's absorbed and metabolized in the body. Anyway, so when we eat carbohydrates, they, for the most part, are broken down into either glucose, into fructose, or into galactose. And galactose, we'll just say, okay, that's dairy products. And then fructose would be, you know, like I said, that's fruit sugar, right? But actually anything sweet. So fructose is sweet tasting if we just eat plain crystalline fructose, like agave nectar. Have you ever had agave nectar?
Yes, I have. It's not very flavorful.
No, it's not really.
It's not like it stands out, but I have had it, yeah.
And so agave nectar, they put this on the label. They say it's a low glycemic sweetener. Low glycemic means it doesn't spike the blood sugar, the blood glucose, because it's all fructose. So it's basically 100% fructose. Anyways, so that's different than glucose. Right, so glucose generally is what we find in potatoes and starches, right? So bread and pasta and rice and corn and these, you know, products that aren't necessarily really sweet, but they have a lot of carbohydrate in them.
Anything your mom put as a side to meat when you were growing up.
That's right, right? Meat, you know, yeah. Meat and starch. So we have that starch component, right? And starch, so when we eat a potato, for example, let's just use that. Potato is, you know, 100% glucose. Because you eat a potato, it's not sweet. Eat white bread. Did you ever do the experiment in, like, middle school where you take, like, white bread and you let it dissolve in your mouth? Did you ever do that? Because we have enzymes in our mouth that break that down, and it actually turns a little sweet when you let the light white bread like completely dissolve or get broken down in your mouth. It starts to take on a little sweetness on it because you've broken down that starch with an enzyme called amylase, which we put in. We have it in our saliva, but we have a lot more in our digestive tract. Anyways,
right.
That's glucose, right? So glucose, like I said, it's not sweet, but it's energy du jour, right? So when you eat that potato, your body's like, right? That's like instant energy, right? So you put that into your bloodstream. Once it's in your bloodstream, all the cells in your body like turn, if they've been like burning fat or they've been burning glycogen or, you know, whatever fuel source they've been using, right? Because maybe you haven't eaten for a while. It just flips the switch and it says, oh, well, we got glucose. We're going to shift our attention to glucose and use that up. So all the cells like shift to that, especially the brain, right? The brain loves glucose. So the brain is a real energy hog too. I think it's like what? I think it's like 3 to 5% of our body weight is our brain, something like that. But it uses 20% of our energy. Right?
Wow.
And we use that energy even when we're not, even when we're, you know, sleeping. We think, oh yeah, I'm taking a board exam. I'm using more glucose. Actually not that much more. Like there's just the maintenance energy for your brain is like really high, constant. And you can't not feed your brain, right? You can't not feed your brain.
Right.
You can't not feed your heart. You can't not feed your lungs, right? So there's this constant supply of energy. Even if you're not eating, right? Even if you haven't, if you've been fasting for a week, your brain's still using a bunch of, but brain's still a big old energy hog, and you got to figure out, your body's like saying, oh, I got to prioritize my resources to, you know, give this to my brain. Anyways, so this glucose, right? So that's a potato, and glucose, this is, maybe we've talked about this, but if you have a diabetic that's got a really low blood sugar, right? They're in a hypoglycemic crisis. Maybe they took a little bit too much insulin or something, and their blood glucose is really low. What do you give them?
Orange juice.
Yeah, it's always orange juice is what we say, yes? Actually, the best thing to give them is instant potatoes. Like, take some
but
instant potatoes and mix it in water.
I think they say orange juice because it's easier to find.
Oh, yeah, for sure, right? Just give them orange juice but we tend to think what? We think orange juice, oh, it's sweet. It's going to give them a bunch of, you know, it's going to raise their glucose. But honestly, it's not the sweetness that raises the glucose. It's the glucose part, right? It's the starchy part.
Mm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so instant potatoes, you could mix that in water and chug that and your blood glucose is going to go way high. Or you
my uncle has an emergency drawer and he has bars in it. I wonder, that's probably better, right? Because that's more starchy, a bar.
Yeah, maybe. It depends on how much sugar they put in it, right? But those Clif bars, you know, Clif bars have a really super high glycemic index because partly of the ingredients they're putting in there. But understand, like, who should be eating an energy bar? Like a Clif bar. You remember Clif bar, what's on the cover of the Clif bar?
Yeah, hiker.
Yeah, it's a climber, and he's hanging from a rock with one hand, and he's got a Clif bar in the other one. So what's he looking for?
Quick fix.
Oh, my
gosh.
Something
that's going to keep him going, right?
He needs energy right now to pull himself up on that rock face. Right, it's just like runners. Runners use the gels and the goo and that kind of thing while they're running, when they're in a marathon.
Bikers, yeah.
Bikers, because they need that quick energy, because they need the burst, and they really want glucose. They want it in a form that their body can utilize and utilize quickly, and glucose gives them that quick energy. So fructose doesn't do that, right? So when you drink orange juice, part of that orange juice is fructose, part of it is glucose, whereas the potato is basically 100% glucose, right? Because you can tell that, you know, by how it tastes, right? So the sweeter it is, the more fructose it has. Like a sweet potato, for example, has a lot of glucose, but it's also got fructose in it too, so it's a little bit, you know, tipped in the other direction, right? Anyways, this is a whole long story, right? And it's a story that I've told before, and I tell it a lot, right? Because we tend to think like, oh, it's the orange juice that we need. It's really the glucose that we need, right? And whatever form we get the glucose in may be beneficial. And understand that when we eat glucose with fiber in it, right? So when we eat something that's, you know, now in a natural state instead of being broken down by the food industry or whatever, you know, refined or processed, that fiber does something. So what is fiber? What do you think fiber does to the glucose response?
Maybe tames it to a certain degree.
Yeah, it slows it down. So if you've got fiber and you chew the fiber or whatever and it's in your digestive tract and now your body's like, oh, I'm going to absorb the glucose from this, but it's kind of entwined with fiber. The digestive tract has to work a little harder. It's got to extract that. It slows it down, right? It lowers what we say the glycemic index, right? So that's like the difference between eating, you know, for example, steel-cut oats versus instant oats, Right. So steel cut oats are, you know, there's more, let's say, substance to them, right? Substance meaning fiber. You got to chew through it and that kind of thing. And then so it's so that the glucose in the oats is not going to hit your bloodstream as quickly. It's going to be a little slower, mm-hmm. which is a really good thing, right? So if you're going to get quick energy, maybe we want to like mediate it a little bit. Unless you're climbing a rock face or you're running a marathon, different, you're right, that's different.
Right,
right. But so may, you know, and nobody's really drinking those goos on a regular basis. Those goos, well, I've never really had one. Have you ever had any of those?
My gosh, no. They seem so bizarre to me. And yeah. I'm never that active to justify that.
Well, exactly, right? So that's the whole key is how active are you? You know, what energy are you using? Are you at an energy deficiency or an energy excess? And for the most part, you know, the way that we eat and do things in our culture, we're at an energy excess. So we're constantly saying, eat less, exercise more, which isn't necessarily wrong, but I'm not sure that really encompasses the whole issue, right? That if you just start exercising, you're going to lose weight. You're going to burn all this extra energy. And perhaps when you're younger, you're better at that, right? You're a little bit more metabolically flexible. I mean, I've certainly seen this. I've seen athletes, right? I've seen, you know, retired professional athletes, and, you know, they still eat like they're 22. And they do, but they're not training. This is a problem.
It's too much.
This is a problem.
It's too much.
Exactly, right? And they're, you know, 50. So, but regardless, right? So again, the whole idea is what demands are you placing on your body and how are you fueling that? And glucose is a great energy source. And then just by adding fiber, you're going to slow that down. But the real crux here is that fructose does not spike your glucose. So when you drink that orange juice, only the glucose part of the orange juice is giving you energy, is giving you glucose to raise you out of hypoglycemic, you know, crisis. Mm. And it's, I mean, you're going to get it. It's just that, I mean, I don't even know the percentage. Let's say it's 60-40. I don't know. I'm guessing right now. It's 60% glucose and 40% fructose, something like that, right? So the glucose part goes right to your bloodstream. And especially we like the juice part, right? Because you could say, well, eat an orange. But an orange isn't the same as orange juice.
Right?
The orange juice is going to kind of streamline it a little bit. Compared
it's lacking the fiber, right?
Exactly. So, and that's an interesting thing. I mean, I think about that too. I mean, how much apple juice can you drink? I mean, you could drink apple juice really quickly, right? How many apples could you actually eat?
Right, maybe three.
Maybe. Man, I've done that and I feel like, oh my gosh, I'm going to explode. But I could easily drink three apples worth of juice in like less than a minute.
Right.
So again, that's what we do, right? We concentrate, we extract, we process, we streamline glucose. Because when people are eating and they need quick energy, and think about that, that's why we, you know, why are you snacking? Why do we snack? Why do we have so many eating occasions?
Why do we have so many what options?
Eating occasions, right? Occasions to eat occasions. Right? I mean, back in 1977, we used to eat 3.5 meals a day, right? Which means basically one day you're eating three meals, the next day you're eating three meals and a snack. So we're snacking maybe every other day. I mean, that's average, right? Of course, some people more and some less. But you know what it is today? Well, not today. The data I have is like 2007. Do you know how many meals we were eating a day on average?
Five.
Yeah, like 5.5.
Like, because school trains us to do that.
Well, for sure. Like, where's the snack? I need a snack. I need a snack after I do this. And again, why are we snacking? Is it just because we need something, or is it because we need energy? Right. I mean, if we're running a marathon, that really makes sense that we're snacking. And like, we'd like to snack all the time during the race, like a constant snack. But that's because we need it. We're putting demands on our body versus just getting used to this fact, oh, it's 3:00, I need my afternoon snack. It's 8:30 at night, I'm going to have my evening snack. A bowl of ice cream. And the snacking is just problematic. I think you're just more times to eat. Who wins by having more eating occasions? Like, who really likes that?
Well, it's great marketing. You're going to sell more snacks.
Of course, right? And it becomes like we're moving away from meals. We just eat mini meals. We just eat snacks, and it's of the package variety, right? So it's something that's prepackaged. Oh, but I want something healthy, so I want a healthy bar. A bar? Like, what is that? I mean, they can put bars, and they can just put nuts, and they can put some, you know, maple syrup in there, and they can put some raisins, and they can do that. I mean, they could put real food and put it into a bar, but you're still deliberately, you know, making something to give that to you in a convenient, you know, convenient package. So this is the idea of coming back to this whole idea of what is glucose. Is glucose is quick energy, but glucose also gets us into trouble if we do too much or if we can't manage it properly, right? Because like I said, when you eat glucose, all bets off, your body's going to have to manage that. And then, you know, one of the epidemics we see today, I mean, you know, what are the things that we're dealing with in this culture? I mean, we die of cardiovascular disease and cancer. I mean, that's been pretty stable for a long period of time. And remember, we got to die of something. So, you know, it's just that the question is when we die, right? I think that's the bigger question, right? You dying of a heart attack at 62 is a lot different than dying of a heart attack at 89. Right. But they both
died
of a heart attack.
I mean, it's how we die as well. I don't know. In macrobiotics, it was always about, did they die of natural causes? That's always the goal.
Yeah, right. Or just die in your sleep on the beach in Cancun, right? That's kind of how I look at it. Like the functional aging curve, that you're you know, physically active and mentally alert, and then all of a sudden, boom, I'm dead. There was no like slow gradual decline where it's like now I'm you know, barely functioning. But that's how we measure things, right? I mean, this culture of ours, we value life and we value life being alive, right? So we go to heroic measures to keep people alive. And I'm not saying that's wrong. It's just that's what carries us. And conventional medicine's super good at that, right? They excel in that. Heroic stuff? Fantastic. They're really good. But how do we like gracefully age so that we can just die in our beach, you know, in our sleep on the beach in Cancun when we're, you know, whatever, 85? I don't know. But, you know, it's quality of life. Quality of life is now somewhat subjective. Anyways, so glucose, though, so what are the diseases that we deal with? I mean, what are we dealing with in epidemic proportions these days? You can probably tell me.
Obesity, diabetes,
yes.
Heart stuff of all kinds, yep. Heart attacks, strokes.
Yep, heart attacks and strokes have been there, right? They're not new. They've been there for a while, right? It's just obesity is still relatively recent phenomenon. If we go back to the 70s, we don't see at all the same level of obesity that we see today. So that's a big change in, you know, 50 years. Like, that's right. Not a genetic thing. There's something else going on, right? So, obesity. What about diabetes? You know what the numbers on diabetes are?
I know what the numbers are?
Yeah,
everybody is pre-diabetic, it seems like, and childhood obesity is off the charts.
Yep. And you understand that in diabetes, right, we have type 1 and type 2 diabetes. So type 1 is basically that's autoimmune. It means your pancreatic cells can't produce insulin. They've, you know, those specific cells have been killed more or less, and you can't produce insulin. That's like a big time issue, right? You're going to die. This is, you got to replace that insulin. So that means, and that's about 5% of diabetes is the type 1 variety. 95% of it is type 2. Type 2 means that they're producing insulin, right? So insulin, we've talked about, that's the hormone that helps you regulate glucose. If you don't have any insulin, that's a big problem. Insulin, type 2 diabetes means that now you produce insulin, but you got to overproduce it, or it's not working as well, and you're not able to clear that glucose from your bloodstream very well, or you're working hard to do that. right? So that's type 2 diabetes. But the numbers on that are basically one out of three people that, you know, born today, this actually may be higher than this, one in three are going to develop diabetes in their lifespan, right? Somewhere along the way. But again, understand that we manage diabetes. I mean, this, again, what conventional medicine is good at, right? So they'll go in there and they'll manage the disease state, right? They'll say, oh, we can give you medications. And I mean, you could change your diet for sure. But, you know, we're managing that. I remember when insulin, insulin was discovered in like the early 1920s. And by a Canadian researcher, right, Banting. That's a long story. But they discovered insulin. And insulin, when it was discovered in the 1920s, was thought to be what? The cure for diabetes. Right, because they knew there was something going on, that all we got to do is figure that out, and we can type it and figure out the chemical formula of that, and then now we can basically, you know, cure diabetes. So we've had insulin since the 1920s, and have we cured diabetes?
My gosh, far from it, right?
Far from it. But we've managed diabetes, right? So in other words, we have a tool, insulin, which we can give to people, which really helps them live with diabetes, right? So they're not dying of diabetes in the short run.
But this is the quality of life we go back to.
Well, we're not treating the cause of the problem, and it didn't, like, cure the diabetes. It's just managing the diabetes, right? Because you're putting the hormone in there, that the hormone does the work to say, hey, wow, you got to clear that glucose, and here you can take this. The problem is that in type 2 diabetes, they often have enough insulin. And at early stages, they don't need more insulin because they got plenty. It's just that their body's not really listening to it, or, you know, it's working hard, or they've overwhelmed it, or they're losing their glucose tolerance, right? So that's a key thing, right? Glucose tolerance. And glucose tolerance, what I mean by that is your ability to manage that carbohydrate when you eat it, specifically the potato, right? Because that's more glucose in there. So this idea of glucose tolerance means that how many potatoes can you eat till it becomes a problem, right? It's like immune tolerance. I really look at this.
It'll be different for everybody as well.
Of course. Right? And then it changes over time. You may be more tolerant of glucose when you're 20 than when you're 40 and when you're 60. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't tend to get better with age. Right? We tend to lose our glucose tolerance. And again, some of us quick. I mean, sometimes it's a 5-year-old that loses their glucose tolerance. And they develop type 2 diabetes at 5 years old. I mean, I've seen them. It's very interesting because we used to call that something else. Type 2 diabetes used to be known as adult onset diabetes.
Right.
You get it when you're an adult. You get it when you're 50. This is something. But now I see it in 5-year-olds. Like, what's going on? Now, you can, if you want to guess on their parents, if you want to guess on the status of their parents, you can probably tell me about their parents right now. What do you think when I see a 5-year-old with diabetes?
Well, I mean, they may be big into snacks.
They may be big into snacks, but they're both diabetic.
Yes, right.
Right, both parents are diabetic. So it's kind of like we got a bad mix here, right? And so there is a genetic predisposition. There's a genetic predisposition that they're going to develop glucose intolerance quicker than somebody else.
And is that genetics, or is that the fact that they're being raised in the same environment that their parents grew up in?
That's a good question. That's a good question. The environmental does play a role in that. But genetics is still something, right? But regardless, are these brand new genes? Are these genes that weren't there 100 years ago? I mean, genes don't change quickly.
Right.
Right. I mean, there's things that happen and we adapt and we sort of shift towards different things, or drift is maybe a better word. There's this drifting that happens, right? We think of it, survival of the fittest, right? But But this idea that those genes are, there's nothing new, right? The gene pool, I don't think, is brand new in the last 50 years. There's something else that's brand new. What's brand new? And I'd say that's been going on for 150 years. And kind of a slow, gradual decline. What has changed?
Our food quality?
Oh, my gosh, yes. The food quality, what we actually eat, that shift is, you know, phenomenal. Phenomenal change in our the kinds of foods that we eat and what we eat. And again, then does what we eat lead to the amount that we eat? Because we just tell people to eat less. But does the food industry really want us to eat less?
Doubtful.
Doubtful. Well, they don't mind if we don't eat it. They want us to buy it, though, right? If you buy it and throw it away, they're okay with that.
Yeah.
But they're deliberately developing food products that do what? That entice us to
eat
it.
Hurt our health.
Yeah, well, I don't think they're deliberately hurting our health, but they're hurting our health because of what they're doing to try to stand out and get people to eat something, right?
Yeah, and they're also trying to be efficient, too. I mean, I'm going to give them a slight benefit of the doubt. I think that, for instance, when we started feeding animals so much corn and soy, it leaves byproducts, right? I mean, and so we have all of this excess corn and soy in the pipeline, so to speak, and so they've become quite brilliant at repurposing all sorts of corn products in the form of, you know, corn syrup and other things, and then the additives of soy as well. So
yes.
I mean, I think that's part of it as well, is that we've kind of screwed up the animals and what they're supposed to be eating, and then we're almost a byproduct of that part of it too.
That's right. Hey, should we do a station check?
My gosh, yes.
You let me and I don't stop.
Oh, I know. Thank you so much for tuning in to listener-supported WDRT 91.9 in Viroqua, Wisconsin. You're listening to The Skeptical Naturopath with Paul Rattay and the timeless, as in not paying attention to time, Christina DeRocher.
Yeah, and have we even touched the book yet? Oh, my gosh.
My goodness.
It's a part two.
So, I mean, but you're laying out the understanding,
yeah,
right?
I'm laying it out. So, and it's interesting you talk about the animals, right? So we feed the animals, right? And we feed them. And why do we feed them what we feed them? What's the incentive?
It's cheaper and easier, because otherwise you have to have a lot of land and they have to have grazing, and they're eating natural you know, byproducts of owning such a land, and you have to be very conscientious about how you steward that land to allow it to keep coming back for those animals, right? So I think it's much easier to say, great, I've got, you know, the corn and the soy and the filler foods, and here we go. I mean, I don't think that they're doing it to be cruel. I think it's more quote-unquote efficient.
Yeah, it's efficient, and we can raise animals very quickly, and we can raise, so we're basically, we've got commodities, right? We've got a lot of soy, we've got a lot of corn, and we can turn it into animal protein, right? We can turn it into protein. And, you know, that's the whole big deal. Like, should we just be eating the soy and not feeding the soy to the animal? Like, should we be eating plants and not eating animals? But animals concentrate that, right? So when we eat, you know, protein from an animal, we eat an animal, we get a much higher percentage of, you know, nitrogen or of protein in that we use as a building block. I mean, all plants have protein in them, they just aren't a dense source, which means we got to eat a lot more of that to get that protein, right? It's like the orangutan. You see how much an orangutan eats on a daily basis, and right, they're vegetarian.
Right, just to get what they need.
Just to get what they need. They have to eat a tremendous amount, right? So that's the idea that, okay, well, if we're going to eat plants, how much protein do we need? And then that's another debate, right? Because it's a debate that goes on and on and on. Like, how much protein do we need? But regardless, so we feed these animals, and we're doing it because it's, first of all, certainly cost-effective. It's also a quick way to get them up to weight, right? I mean, I don't know the timing on a grass-fed animal versus a corn-fed animal, but I you know, and farmers are paid by what? They're not paid by quality of the meat. They're paid by weight. Right? So if part of that weight is fat, you'd be like, wow, that's great. Because protein's the harder part of that, right? Anyway, so that, I mean, that's what we've done as a culture, right? I mean, we've extracted and processed, and we've, you know, really refined things to be able to deliver something from a, you know, from a capitalistic, can I make money on this? Right? And what we've done is we've completely ruined the food chain, and I think that that now leads to the, you know, the obesity epidemic in the last 50 years, the diabetes epidemic, you know, that we're seeing today, right? And everybody's pre-diabetic. Or, you know, then there's even pre-diabetes. I know I've talked about pre-diabetes. So maybe yes. This is a good segue on this. So do you know what the definition of diabetes is?
The definition of diabetes.
So we make a diagnosis, right? Again, this is like kind of classic conventional medicine, right? So how do we diagnose these things? Like, what does the test tell us? So for diabetes, we need a fasting blood glucose over 125, an A1C. Do you know what an A1C is?
That's your blood sugar levels over time.
Yep, that's like a 3-month average. So that's using an A1C and just a fasting glucose, which just tells me what your glucose is right now when I got drawn, right, at that moment in time. Because your glucose constantly changes. But taking a fasting one, we're trying to say, okay, well, you haven't eaten for a while. What's your glucose doing that? If your blood glucose is high after you haven't, you know, fasted for 12 hours, then we're kind of like, you're not managing your glucose very well. But anyway, so if you're over 125 and you have an A1C, I think over 6.4, right? Then we could say, oh, that's diabetes. The thing is that now we recognize that there's pre-diabetes, right? Pre-diabetes means, oh, maybe we don't want to wait till you're, you know, at the full-blown diabetes stage, but now we've got pre-diabetes. So what's the definition of pre-diabetes? That's a fasting blood sugar, blood glucose between 100 and 125, and an A1C basically between 5.7 and 6.4, right? So diabetes is now, we could call it a spectrum disorder. It's spectrum meaning you start at one end and then you end up at the other end. So you move on the spectrum through life, right? My 5-year-old moved through that in 5 years and 9 months. I'm gonna say gestational time, what's going on while you're, you know, in mom's womb. Like, that's really super important time on establishing your blood glucose regulation. Like, we see that, for example, during World War II and what happened to children that were, you know, born in that time frame. And do we see higher levels? So this is kind of the thrifty gene. There's a thrifty gene hypothesis on that. But let's not get... Well, just how they adapt to being in, you know, not having enough nutrients. And, you know, there's something called the thrifty gene hypothesis that can lead to weight gain and diabetes and other things because their genes are being thrifty because they realize they're not getting something, so they have to adapt to that. But okay. Regardless, you start to set that in place while you're in utero. So that 9 months can be really super important. And again, we look at that with women for sure, that if they're, you know, gestational diabetes, right? So gestational diabetes in my world is basically pre-diabetes. So a woman may just be diabetic during pregnancy, but then be totally fine once the pregnancy's over. But I'd be saying, wow, but you had this? You had a blood glucose dysregulation while you were carrying a child? You have a blood glucose dysregulation. You're just not... You know, you're on that spectrum somewhere. We don't need to wait. We don't need to wait and see what's going to happen. Because I look in my magic eight ball and I'm worried.
Yeah.
Right. So, and again, what do you do about it? Right. You're not going to take medications or anything, but you certainly start looking at lifestyles, certainly diet things that make a difference. And again, then this is where you start looking at glucose tolerance. Right. So. Yeah, so that's glucose in a nutshell. And so the issue with diabetes, so there's, again, well, I didn't finish this thought. So we have diabetes, we have pre-diabetes, and conventional medicine recognizes that now. So if you've got a fasting blood sugar over 100 and A1C of, 5.9, they're going to say, oh, you're pre-diabetic. And they may say, well, we'll wait 3 months and we'll retest you, or 6 months, or we'll give you metformin. So metformin is kind of first-line therapy, first-line medication for pre-diabetes. It helps you utilize glucose better. Problem is, there's so metformin is working on it's improving the glucose, the insulin response to food, right? So it's kind of helping your once that glucose is there, that you respond better.
Okay.
So it kind of kickstarts that. If you want to think about that. And I mean, it helps, yes. Side effects from it cause a lot of GI complaints, that kind of thing. But the issue is that, we've got a pill to fix that, right? Or to try to manage that early, because then this is just going to get worse, and then we're going to have to do more, bigger guns or, whatever. We'll do other medications to try to work on that. Like Ozempic, right, which is really super popular right now, right? I don't want to spend too much time on that because that's a whole nother rabbit hole. But that's working on a sort of a different pathway, but it makes you feel full. That's why people are all over it now, because they're like, oh, I don't want to eat. I take Ozempic and, I don't eat as much as I used to because my feeling of fullness happens quicker.
Right.
And that's a good thing, yes? I mean, for sure. The question is, can you figure out how to eat so that happens rather than that you have to take a drug? And the problem with Ozempic is you got to take it forever.
Many and varied.
Well, many and varied. You can see, adverse effects, but really the bigger picture is you got to be on that forever. You can't not take it. It's a lifestyle drug.
Yeah.
And big pharma, they love lifestyle drugs. Why do they like lifestyle drugs?
Well, that's cradle-to-grave marketing.
Exactly.
And selling.
You got to take it for the rest of your life. It's like being on a statin drug for cholesterol. You can't, take a statin drug for 2 years and then say, oh, well, now I'm going to go off my statin. I fixed my cholesterol, and now I'm going to go off it. No, they go off it, and their blood cholesterol goes up. Same thing with blood pressure meds, too. And again, I'm not saying that that's a wrong way, but it's just certainly you're not treating the cause of the problem. You're treating part of it.
Right.
You're treating a risk profile. But the whole idea is, well, maybe I'd make some changes so that I don't need this. Like, is there a way that, people want to get off their blood pressure medications? They're like, oh, I want to get off this. I'm like, okay, first of all, what's your blood pressure? They don't know. I'm like, wow, you don't even know your blood pressure? You need to get a blood pressure cuff so you've got data. You don't have any data points here, right? I mean, so we're going to make changes and we don't even know? You just get your blood pressure done when you go to the medical doctor? Yeah, but I don't want to take the pills. I don't want to take the meds. I'm like, well, that's good, but you got to change something. Because the blood pressure pill is dealing with the symptom, not necessarily the cause. But anyway, so they don't have a cuff. They need to buy a cuff. And then the other thing is, what kind of changes are you going to make? Right? And that's the harder one. They're like, oh, I'll just take the natural. Just give me magnesium and that'll work. I'm like, yeah. I mean, I'll give you magnesium. I love giving magnesium and potassium. I mean, those could be helpful, but they're not the same as taking a blood pressure pill. But anyways, it's looking at the whole context. So, but the idea is so that we've got diabetes and pre-diabetes, but then I call something pre-diabetes. So this is now somebody that is on that spectrum, but if I measure their blood glucose and their A1C, it's totally normal.
Really?
Right? Yeah, it's totally normal. So why would I call it pre-diabetes? I mean, this is me. Maybe somebody else has done this. Maybe this is specific to me. Maybe I'm completely off my rocker too, which is certainly possible. Hey, do we need to do another check here since we were behind on the other one?
Can,
where are we at?
Yeah, sure. We can do one more. Thank you so much for listening to listener-supported WDRT 91.9 here in Viroqua, Wisconsin. You're listening to The Skeptical Naturopath with Paul Rete and Christina DeRocher.
Yes. So, anyway, so pre-diabetes, somebody's totally normal, completely normal A1C, completely normal blood glucose. But they, I label them as pre-diabetes. That means you could be pre-diabetic. I could be pre-diabetic. How would I know that? Like, what do you think that I would maybe pay attention to that would give me some indication of that? I kind of said one, right? So one would be potentially gestational diabetes, right? So if a woman had gestational diabetes, I'd basically say, well, you're pre-diabetic, or maybe pre-diabetic if we're testing your levels and they're fine. But let's go a little deeper, right? Because I've talked all about the continuous glucose monitor and how much I love that, because that tells me what your blood glucose is doing, right? It gives me this pattern that I can see at any given moment, and I can see how are you responding to the food that you're eating. Are you over responding? Are you managing it well? Really valuable. But there's something else that would be that I would like to test that's more valuable than even glucose. Do you know what that is?
Not your A1C.
Not A1C, because we do that regularly. So we do an A1C and a glucose. I mean, people have that information all the time.
Oh, okay. So maybe your fasting?
Yep. Glucose. So fasting glucose, yep. Typically we do it fasting. I'll give you a hint. It's a hormone.
Cortisol?
Not cortisol. Ooh, I do love cortisol, but this one is even more important. We've already talked about it. The hormone that regulates glucose.
Which one is that?
It starts with an I.
Insulin.
Yeah, insulin.
That was a little too obvious.
Yeah,
sorry.
I know. This happens. So understand. So when you eat the potato, your blood glucose goes up, and your body shunts and your body shifts and says, hey, I got to use all this glucose, and starts doing that. But insulin is then released because insulin amplifies that. Like, insulin helps that work much better. Right? So insulin is working behind the scene to say, hey, we've got glucose, we need to use that. Or that causes an abrupt, what we call bolus insulin. Insulin does other things too. I don't want to get into that. That's a whole nother story. I will talk about that story, but that's at a later time. But regardless, so we secrete insulin to clear the glucose from the bloodstream, right? So and I mentioned that glucose tolerance means that okay, you eat a carbohydrate, your blood glucose goes up, but you come back down, right? You manage it properly. Right? And you could exercise and do some things that'll help that, but insulin is the main player there. Right? So what do you think that I would see in somebody that's pre-diabetic now? So their blood glucose is normal, their A1C is normal, but what do you think is going on with their insulin?
It's fluctuating.
It's fluctuating, but fluctuating on which side? Is it going to be low or high? 50-50 shot here. No, it's going to be high.
It's going to be high.
Because so what's going on is this person is now having to produce more insulin to help manage their blood glucose.
Oh, okay.
Because that's what we do. Yes. We are, we're highly motivated to keep our glucose under control. And this is why the silence in diabetes, right? Silence or the spectrum on it. Because we don't know that you're compensating really hard to make this work, because the external manifestation of that is totally normal. Mm-hmm. See, but the thing is that like blood pressure and cholesterol are not tightly regulated in your body, which means we're going to see issues with those things before we see issues with blood glucose. Right? That's super important. Super, super important, because there's something called metabolic syndrome. Right? You've heard of metabolic syndrome?
I think you've mentioned
it
before.
Yeah, I talk about it all the time, right? So, see, this is the thing, right? You're a good test, Christina, because we've been doing this for how long? It's 3 years, right?
Yeah.
And I tend to repeat myself, right? But I repeat myself in kind of different context. And there's this idea, like, with my students, right? But it's not I don't have a three-year class, right? I have them for 15 weeks. And the idea is like, oh, well, if I just repeat myself like 5 times, they'll remember it.
I mean, I think that's great. I think that's a good
I don't think it works, yeah. though. I think if they're really motivated by that, perhaps, right, there needs to be a little bit more intrinsic motivation rather than just repetition. Because they'll be just like, you're repeating yourself. I'm not going to remember that, but you already told me that. But I don't care.
Right.
And if you don't care, then, you know, it won't be remembered, right? So it's that developing curiosity. Anyways, so we've got this insulin that's now at high levels because you're trying to manage it. But you're managing it just fine. It's just that you're over-secreting a hormone to do that. So doing a fasting insulin is a super, super important test for me. Right? Because then maybe I pick up on somebody that's pre-diabetic.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, conventional medicine doesn't matter. They don't worry about that so much because there's nothing that they're going to do. They're going to wait until, oh, you're pre-diabetic. We'll give you metformin. And, yeah, you need to lose weight and exercise more. But, you know, they say that all the time. And, you know, that's true per se. But, I mean, tell me how I'm going to do that. Like, let's get into a little bit more detail than just telling me the kind of the pat answer. But anyway, so doing a fasting insulin is super important for me because I can start to detect this early. And when I detect it early, then I start to have the conversation to say, hey, you're losing some glucose tolerance here. Maybe you need to start thinking about things that you could do to help build the glucose tolerance so that 10 years from now, we're not having a story about diabetes.
Right.
Because it's so much easier to prevent it than it is to treat it. And treating it means that we're hitting it, you know, with medication. Now I'm telling you to go on a ketogenic diet permanently. I mean, sort of, right? But the whole idea is now carbohydrates are the bad guy for you. And carbohydrates aren't a bad guy. They're not a bad guy. Right? I want to be clear. Like, there's no good guy, bad guy. I mean, there's things that we do to foods that make it much more problematic. But a potato's a potato, right? I mean, for a potato for a diabetic may be much more problematic than a potato to somebody that's, you know, not diabetic or pre-diabetic. But if I can start to detect that early, then we can start to intervene and say, hey, wow, maybe you need to be a little bit more conscious. Now maybe this is where you wearing a continuous glucose monitor would be super important, because you need to be able to see how you're responding to carbohydrates and things that you could do that could kind of flatten that curve a little bit, if we want to think about it that way. Right? So, I mean, this is the value of a continuous glucose monitor, is you get to see your glucose tolerance. And some people, it doesn't make any difference, right? They don't even need to do that, because their glucose control as well. But the whole idea is I may have a, you know, subset, or I know something about you that I'm going to say, hey, you know what? A CGM would be a really useful tool for you, right? And maybe I see that because I do fasting insulin, but I have to do that on a test, right? I can't look at somebody and say your insulin's elevated. But I could look at somebody and ask them some questions that make me think like there's a problem. Right, if they're hangry, if they have reactive hypoglycemia, right, if they're saying I have to eat 6 meals a day because I know if I don't eat something I'm going to get angry, I'm not going to feel good, and these things are going to happen, I'm like, whoa, we've got some reactive hypoglycemia going on here. I think that you may be losing your glucose tolerance, even though your numbers look completely fine. And even in a case like that, their fasting insulin could be just fine. Maybe then I got to call it pre-diabetes. I don't know. But you just look at that and I say, wow, I worry about that. And that perhaps just the idea of figuring out how to balance your carbohydrates with other macronutrients may be super important for you. Right? So this is the kind of the lay of the land, right? And trying to figure out when to intervene and how much to intervene and when to have the conversation. But, you know, people don't necessarily want to change their diet, right? And then thus the premise of this book, The Glucose Revolution, is saying, how can you take charge of your glucose response? How can you do things that improve your glucose tolerance, right? So I think there's very useful information there. Right, that's certainly a useful thing. It's just, again, who actually needs to do that? But when we look at one-third of Americans are going to develop diabetes in their lifespan, one third of Americans should be following that.
Right.
It's like
this
going
is
off.
Actually,
go ahead.
This is we're at time actually, so it's a perfect segue to talk about the book next time.
That's right. I see we got like 3 minutes left.
Okay.
So, but yeah, we just set the plate to say, okay, so where are you at? What are your what's your symptom picture? And do I need to like actually do this? Right. And I mean, I'm a guy. I mean, if you ask me, I'd be like, everybody should wear a CGM for 2 weeks and just kind of see what's going on. Right. Just get an idea of what's going on with your blood glucose. Even if you wear it for 2 weeks and then you don't wear it again, or a month, 4 weeks. And then you're like, hey, maybe I'll do this like once every 2 years. And you keep that data, right? Because I've done that. I wore my first CGM probably like 7 years ago. And at that time, it was a script item. So I had to, you know, I had to get it through through a nurse practitioner or something to be able to get it, because I couldn't get a script. I can't write a script for a glucose monitor.
Okay.
So my qualifications don't work for that. But regardless, so I wore one, you know, 7 years ago, and I saw my pattern, and it was pretty consistent to what I thought, right? And then now when I wear it, where I've been wearing them, I've worn a lot in the last 8-9 months to get more data to say, hey, what's going on? And I'm going to tell you, for me, I've drifted a little bit. My A1C, I'm actually pre-diabetic on my A1C. I'm at the borderline in the A1C. That's really kind of shocking. I'm like,
wow. Considering what you eat.
Wow, yeah, I know. But what that is that I think there's the difference between this idea of skinny fat. Have you heard of skinny fat? Boy,
yes,
that's more than 2 minutes. That's more than a two-minute conversation. But here's the nutshell of it. So actually gaining weight is a way that you protect yourself from diabetes. Seems really odd, because there's people that are overweight and obese that do not have diabetes. And you're like, well, wait a minute, you become obese and then you get diabetes. And yes, that does happen, but there's other people that are kind of healthy obese, at least from a blood sugar level. So what's going on with them? They're able to take their extra glucose, right? If they eat too much or whatever, they've got a lot of fat cells, so they put it in their fat cells. And if it's in their fat cells, it's not in their bloodstream, and everything looks fine. Like their insulin may be totally normal, their A1C, their fasting glucose is totally fine, because they've got a lot of reservoirs to take that glucose and get it out of the bloodstream and put it somewhere. Right, so that's, let's say, healthy fat, if you want to call it, healthy obese, but I'm saying healthy from the blood sugar perspective.
Yeah.
On the other hand, then there's kind of skinny fat, and skinny fat, or just this idea that now in certain people, which I think I'm one of them, that I get extra energy and I don't have anywhere to put it. Like, I don't have a lot of fat cells, or my fat cells are just kind of full. Right, so then now it doesn't have anywhere to go, and if it has nowhere to go, where's it going to go? It's going to go to my liver, it's going to stay in my bloodstream, and then I start to see that. I mean, that's super interesting, right? And I could tell you, I mean, rice is my killer. If I go eat ramen, oh my gosh, my blood glucose is off the chart. It's terrible on my glucose monitor. But I know that, right? It's because I wear a CGM and I know this, so I'm looking at that information to try to say
it's
how
probably
do I
changed over
it.
Time for you as
yes,
well.
Yes, exactly, because I tell you 7 years ago it wasn't a problem at all. But anyway, I'm just giving perspective on that. Like, why would my A1C be like borderline? Like, that's really curious to me. But I've kind of known that because I've been measuring my A1C over time. But anyways, I think we're at time now. We will continue this conversation on giving sort of more nuts and bolts and talk more about like what she's mentioning in that Glucose Revolution book next time.
Great. I look forward to that, Paul. Thank you.
All right, Christina.
Till next time.
Bye-bye.